Hello, I'm David O'Keefe. This is number 0159, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0159. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Peter Geiger, editor of the Farmer's Almanac. He's back on the show to talk about the latest edition of the publication.
I just love the way in which the Almanac kind of touches all people in different formats. And you know, whether you're in Canada or the United States, we all have kind of similar kind of interests and needs. And then, you know, we've got a common interest in comets and blue moons and full moons. And all of this is what makes, I think, a common experience for all of us.
Mary Jane Popp is the author of Marilyn, Joe, and Me, a new book about Marilyn Monroe with stories told by someone who knew her, June DiMaggio, the niece of Joe DiMaggio. There are already a host of books out there about the screen legend.
Yeah, there's a lot of books out there, and there's going to be rumors out the yazoo for eternity. However, I wanted to talk to someone who was there, who knew Marilyn, and June knew Marilyn for like 11 years, who was part of the family. She was part of her family. She married Joe DiMaggio, June's uncle. So I wanted someone who had the firsthand experience. That's the reason I got involved in this project, and that's the reason it's a work of love.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge, such as the story of when he was introduced to the first man to walk on the moon by the widow of General Douglas MacArthur.
While we're talking to her, I get a feeling that there's somebody standing behind me. And before I can continue that thought process, Mrs. Douglas MacArthur says, "Lalina and Peter, I'd like you to meet my very good friend Neil Armstrong." So I turn around, and he's there, and he extends his hand to me. And of course, I shook his hand, which, by the way, I've never washed since that day.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0159, was military historian and documentary filmmaker David O'Keefe. His current film is Dieppe Uncovered, which tells the story of Canada's tragic losses during the Dieppe Raid of World War II. Thank you very much, David, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Much appreciated. The Stuff File program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio, with well over 5,000 shows available to you for your listening pleasure. Well over 5,000 shows. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, the first time that Thomas Lee Nunez, age 61, pulled a gun on a cop was 17 years ago. He survived, but lost an eye in the resulting gunfight. The gun was his wife's. She was a police officer herself. Now, this time, Nunez went out drinking with his wife to celebrate her retirement. While at a bar, Lisa Nunez, who retired as a lieutenant from the Oregon City, Oregon Police Department, was exchanging texts and photos with another man. By the way, she was on her 10th beer. When Thomas saw what she was doing and what was on her phone, he went, well, best way to put it is, ballistic. "I couldn't believe she was doing it right in front of my face," Thomas said. "I felt betrayed." Lisa shrugged it off. She said, "I'm 54 years old. I have a relationship with my husband that's non-existent." She later said, "I was just sexting a guy. It's not a big deal." Wow. She's retiring from the police department, huh? Just shrugged that one off. Okay, Thomas went home, smoked some pot, and talked the situation over with his cats to reason out a plan. Yes, you heard me right. He talked it out with his cats. Now, what have I always said on this program about cats? Cats are evil. Little pieces of evil plotting against mankind. So perhaps the cats are partially to blame for this story. But anyway, I digress. Let me go on. By then, Lisa was home and had gone to sleep, so Thomas grabbed her gun and fired a shot inches from her head to wake her up. After hearing the case, Clackamas County Circuit Judge Kathy F. Steele declared, "The mind is boggled, and sentenced Thomas to 10 years in prison on weapons charges, leaving Lisa in tears. Because every enabler needs an enablee. Anyway, moving right along. The way it usually happens is mom and dad start a road trip with their children, but after a rest stop, they fail to notice that one of the kids is not on board, and they may be well down the road before they turn around. However, in June, the family member left behind at a Memphis, Tennessee rest stop was Dad. And for 100 miles, no one grasped the idea that he was actually missing. The family was traveling in a van, and everyone presumed Dad was in the back. He was still at the gas station calling his own phone, which, by the way, was in the back of the van. Dad finally reached Mom in the van by posting on Facebook. Now, what I want to know is, if no one was around to answer the phone, which was in the back of the van, who the heck was looking at Facebook on the open road? That's what I want to know. Just asking. Anyway, in June, inmate Michelle Richards, age 33, was about to begin her sentence at the Albany County, New York jail when guards discovered a hypodermic needle and 7 packets of heroin inside her vagina. She had been arrested for possessing a needle and heroin in her bra. Richards' arrest came about a week after another inmate, Andrea Amanitides, was caught at the same jailhouse using the same hiding place to sneak in heroin and 256 prescription pills. Andrea's stash was discovered when the baggie holding it became dislodged and broke open on the floor. Well, at the risk of being rude, one has to ask, just how cavernous are these vaginas anyway? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Witnesses inside the theater, according to Sparks, Nevada Police Sergeant Pei Dyer, stated that a man in the audience was adjusting himself in his seat when a gun he had on him discharged. Despite the incident happening just weeks after the mass theater shooting in Aurora, Colorado, the audience, which was watching The Bourne Legacy, did not panic, but the man stood up, apologized to the audience near him, ran out, and was gone by the time police arrived. Officers checked area hospitals and found the man being treated for a gunshot wound to his butt. The unnamed 56-year-old man, who does have a concealed weapons permit, was cooperative with police and admitted that his gun fell out of his pocket, and when it hit the floor, it discharged. Dyer said it is illegal in Nevada, a misdemeanor, to either intentionally or negligently discharge or cause the discharge of a firearm in a theater. And according to City Attorney Chet Adams, he added the man will likely be charged with that crime. Okay. I'm not even going to go into the whole carry permit issue because that's just flogging a dead horse, but let's just look at it from this guy's perspective. Apparently, he had no trouble being able to afford a $600 pistol, $120 mandatory training class, $105 carry permit. Didn't choose, however, to afford the $40 holster. Wow. Shooting yourself in the ass in a public theater is almost worthy of being the idiot of the day, but he's not. That comes later. Let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? A perennial favorite has published its latest edition. The 2013 version of the Farmer's Almanac is now available. Published since 1818, every year, millions of faithful readers seek out the down-home wit, wisdom, and proven advice that has made the Farmer's Almanac a household name. On the line with us right now is Peter Geiger, the publisher and editor of the Farmer's Almanac. Hi, Peter.
Hi, good to be with you again.
Good to have you back on the program with us. So here we are, 2013, the new one just came out. I always look forward to getting it when it shows up in my mailbox. It's a great publication. I'm just curious to know now, with the weird and wacky weather that we've been having over the last little while and the wild swings back and forth, is it getting more difficult to prognosticate a year in advance as to what the weather will be?
Well, that's a great question because it has been rather odd of late, but I don't think it's any more difficult than it's ever been. Last year was a bit of an anomaly, I think. Certainly the winter was. I mean, we had called for some rougher weather. But when I look at what we called for, we also said it would be average or above average in terms of temperature. And in fact, we had some snows in October, another storm in November, and I'm thinking, oh, yes, this is going to be great, and then all of a sudden, nothing. When you're doing the weather, and we do it 2 years in advance, I don't think it's ever easy. You have to work based upon a formula, and you have to work based upon what you have at hand, and then sometimes there are some things that just throw you a curve, and last year was a curveball, and this year I think it won't be.
Human nature always seems that people want to talk about the negative aspects of things. People want to complain.
Yes, I've noticed.
And I'm just I'm just wondering nowadays, especially with the world of social media, and I know Farmer's Almanac is plugged in. You have an online presence on Twitter and Facebook and all the other places. Do you hear from people who say, what happened, guys? What happened with, November of 2012? It wasn't what it was supposed to be, or whatever the case may be.
Yes, I think you get a lot more feedback, but I think for the Farmer's Almanac, it's fairly positive stuff. I mean, there are some people who will complain about something, but the fact that we do it 2 years in advance, I think people are a bit more forgiving, if I'm wrong. If I call for a hurricane or a big storm and I'm off by a day, they might say, well, it's only a day. So I think people tend to be somewhat forgiving, I think, with the Farmer's Almanac. You do get a few people who take a shot at you, but for the most part, people who are either on Twitter or on Facebook or who we've write me letters are pretty much happy with the Farmer's Almanac, because I think we have a purpose in life, and one of the things we do is weather, but then there's a lot of other things we do to make life, I think, easier for people, whether you live in America or Canada or anywhere else. It's a great publication. It's got a following that's almost 200 years in the making, and I'm very pleased with the publication, but you do get that more instant feedback. And then with Facebook in particular, you can ask a question like, what kind of cheese do you put on your hamburger? And you will get, 80 responses in 5 minutes. And if you ever want to know anything, just ask a question.
Well, as you say, this is very popular in both Canada and the United States. I happen to be in Canada, so I'm holding the Canadian version in my hand, which is one of the questions I wanted to ask. Is there, outside of the fact that you have weather for various regions of both countries, is there a big difference between the two editions?
Well, it's probably about 100-page difference, and I would say that there is some more material in the U.S. edition, of course, but we try to keep the crux of the almanac, what we're going to talk about on radio or television, in both. So many of the stories are going to be similar. There obviously will be Canadian stories in the Canadian edition, but there's a lot of information that's obviously transferable between two countries.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the things that we can find inside the edition of the Farmer's Almanac. And for instance, one of the things I noticed is how to use dishwashing soap and or boiling water to kill weeds.
Yes, I mean, yes, this is a big problem. And the thing is, I think one of the things we're trying to do is get people to not buy as many chemicals and pesticides and so forth. But if you just boil hot water and on a nice warm day, pour it on weeds, if you have things growing through cracks, just pour the boiling water and bingo, they're gone. And if you want, you can also put some soap into water and in a container and just spray it on as well. But the hot water works terrifically. This is being a political year for both countries. If you have bumper stickers on your car and you want to all of a sudden get rid of them, all you need to do is wipe white vinegar on the bumper sticker and let it sit for a few minutes, then you can peel it right off.
So wait a minute, rub vinegar?
White vinegar, just take a sponge, right. Dunk it into some white vinegar, rub it over the bumper sticker, and in a few minutes it'll peel off. And if that doesn't work, somebody just told me you can also take a hair dryer and just run it over it, and it will peel off.
Oh, so basically what I can do, if I don't agree with my neighbor's political views, I can, in the middle of the night,
exactly. I hadn't thought in such devious a way as you did.
Okay.
But people sometimes kid because the almanac has a hole in the corner that people take it to the bathroom. And so this year I have a suggestion, which is also to take a can of Coca-Cola with you, because if you pour Coca-Cola in the bathroom toilet and let it sit there for about an hour and just kind of scrub it around, it cleans it immaculately.
Really?
So bring your Coke with your almanac in the bathroom.
Well, and specifically Coca-Cola, doesn't work in any other brands?
I think it's specifically Coca-Cola because there's a fair amount of acidity in it that apparently eats away at the grime.
Wow. Why they don't advertise this fact in their commercials is beyond me.
I don't know, but maybe it's just a new discovery and that they will. But, a story about cutting the cordless cord. I mean, all of us have got, we're always in communication with people, and so we talk about ways in which, maybe you just need to take a little bit of a break every so often and not have the phone on or not be doing texting as you're speaking to somebody at the same time, and all of those things that are becoming a bit culturally annoying at times. So we have a story that talks about how you might cut the cord at some time. We have to be connected, but there are times that maybe we don't have to overdo it. We have a great story on beverages for every season. We have smoothie recipes. We have ways to reduce your trash and waste and all kinds of ways to, you know, the price of fuel keeps going up, so there's ways to cut your gas consumption, ways to cut energy costs around the home, winter and summer. And then, since you are in Canada, there's ways to prevent your pipes from freezing.
Mm. Now, you mentioned seasons. One of the seasons coming up not too far from now is Halloween, and I understand you should be burning thyme around Halloween, and why is that?
Why is that? What page is that one on? I thought you were going to go in a different angle. What do you have the page for?
Oh, it's page 98, I believe.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No problem. See, I always have my almanac handy.
Well, so why is it, Peter? You've got it in front of you. So it wards off the evil spirits. Is that the one?
I believe so, yeah.
Yes. Well, when you mentioned Halloween, I give out like 2,500 candy bars to kids on Halloween, and I have a secret password, and I thought I was going to get into all that kind of stuff. I love Halloween. It's my favorite time, and I haven't warded off any evil spirits. They all come to my house for candy. I love it.
You have been the editor of this publication for quite a while, and so you see everything that goes into all editions of the Farmer's Almanac. I'm just curious to know, since it's always so chock full of information each and every year that's very helpful and informative, is there something you can remember either in this edition or in previous that for you was an aha moment? Like, you know, you must see everything. So what crosses your desk and you go, wow, that's interesting?
I thought the Coke one was pretty interesting, but there was a bunch of years ago when there was a fruit fly problem in California, and somebody noticed that in the Farmer's Almanac the mating call of the fruit fly was equal to the F something on a harmonica, and so she called a national media person, and they put this information out, and it was in the almanac. And my aha was that, you know what, you never know what's in the publication. And so the solution to the fruit fly problem was taking harmonicas off into the ocean and drafting these fruit flies. I mean, it was kind of a silly thing, but it was a little tidbit in the almanac that all of a sudden somebody took into making it into a national story.
So sort of like the Pied Piper of fruit flies is what you're saying with the harmonica?
as it were, yes. At the time, that was the case. But you know, I've had people write to me to find buried treasures because they think that the code is somewhere in an 1800 something almanac, and I just love the way in which the almanac kind of touches all people in different formats, and you know, whether you're in Canada or the United States, we all have kind of similar kind of interests and needs, and then you know we've got a common interest in comets and blue moons and full moons And all of this is what makes, I think, a common experience for all of us.
Do you hear from people who save all their almanacs from year to year?
Yes, many, many times. And many people will contact me wanting to know if they wanted to buy a box of almanacs because their parents or grandparents saved them. But essentially, almanacs were reference books and essentially were kept for generations to enjoy because the information in it was sometimes you want to go back and get a recipe or go back and get a hint and reuse it.
Last question. I know I'm looking ahead, but I mentioned right in the introduction that it was first published in 1818. If I do my math correctly, it means in 5 years you got a big anniversary coming up. Are you planning something special?
Yes, I am. But actually, we're starting to talk about it. We haven't decided exactly what to do. You know, now I've got e-books and I've got so many ways to communicate. I mean, I've got a couple apps in the work. I've got a mobile device. I don't know what the appropriate way in which we're going to kind of trigger off a 200th anniversary. Certainly, the almanac itself will be special, but how you launch it and what fashions people can get it maybe may change. Because as you know, in every 2 or 3 years is some new technology that's out there. So I'm very much looking forward to the 200th anniversary. If I live long enough, which I think I will, it'll be a blast, and I will invite you to the party.
Excellent. People can find out more information by going to your website, which is www.farmersalmanac.com. The new edition is out on stands now, available in several places. And I thank you very, very much, Peter, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter. Always enjoy it.
Peter Geiger, the publisher and editor of the Farmer's Almanac. You can check out their website at farmersalmanac.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0159, and you'll find links to their website.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From Montreal, Canada, and spanning the globe like a butterfly on speed, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the author of Marilyn Joe and Me about Marilyn Monroe, and we have a visit from Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, who shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. And, of course, we do have an idiot of the day, but right now more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. A romantic prankster almost suffocated when he mailed himself to his girlfriend in a sealed box and got lost in the post. Hu Seng from Chongqing City in southern China paid a courier firm to deliver him to his partner, Li Wang, as a joke. But couriers mixed up the address, and instead of 30 minutes in the sealed box, gasping Seng was trapped for nearly 3 hours. By the time the package finally arrived at his girlfriend's office, where a friend was waiting to record her surprise on camera, Seng had passed out and had to be revived by paramedics. "I didn't realize it would take so long," admitted Seng. "I tried to make a hole in the cardboard, but it was too thick, and I didn't want to spoil the surprise by shouting." A spokesman for the courier company commented, "If he had told us what he was doing at the start, we would not have taken the parcel. Even when we accept animals, they have to go in special containers so they can breathe." You know, misery does love company. I mean, as tragic as this story could have turned out to be, what I'm taking away from all of this is that, isn't it nice to know that other countries such as China can also screw up mail delivery? I thought it was just our mail that got lost. Anyway, police in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, were called to a hospital emergency room to chat with a patient. Tavares Donnell Colbert, age 36, told the officers he was on his way to sell a gun in a convenience store parking lot when he decided to pull over to make sure the gun worked. It did. He shot himself in the groin. He panicked and drove himself to the hospital. Colbert wasn't allowed to possess a firearm, let alone sell one, as he is a convicted felon. He was arrested on weapons charges. Now, all we can hope is that he didn't reproduce before this incident, because I'm sure that since the incident, he surely won't be able to now. Okay, under the headline of Perp's Remorse, we got a couple of stories. Jason Adkins was charged in March in Cynthiana, Kentucky, with stealing electronic equipment from the home of a friend. According to police, Adkins admitted the break-in, but he felt guilty the next day and returned the items. However, he then admitted breaking back into the house, so 2 days after that, and re-stealing them. And Perp's Remorse number two, Ivan Barker was sentenced in March in England's Stoke-on-Trent Magistrates Court for stealing a laptop computer and cigarettes from the home of a wheelchair-bound man of his acquaintance. Barker subsequently visited the man and apologized for the theft, but then during that visit, Barker stole the man's new replacement laptop computer and more cigarettes. They just don't get it, do they? Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest with me, Peter Anthony Holder, we have a story here from the Darwin File, because as you know, the tree of life is often self-pruning. A man wearing a bushy military-style camouflage suit in an apparent attempt to impersonate the mythical creature Bigfoot has died after being struck on a Montana highway by not one, but two cars. Randy Lee Tenley, age 44, was dressed in a ghillie, that's an outfit favored by military snipers and game hunters, and standing in the middle of southbound lanes on U.S. Highway 93 near Kalispell when he was struck twice in quick succession. Montana Highway Patrol spokesman Sergeant Steve Lavin said, "From what I understand, at least one of his friends said that he was trying to induce a Sasquatch sighting by using the suit along the highway. This is the first for me after 20 years on the Highway Patrol. It's strange." Tenley was hit by a car driven by a 15-year-old girl. 15-year-olds are allowed to drive in Montana with a learner's permit. A second car driven by a 17-year-old girl struck him moments later when he was already down on the roadway. Police say they don't know which impact killed him. But there you go. Like I say, the tree of life is often self-pruning. Never run out of Darwin File stories. We just never do. Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Actress and pop icon Marilyn Monroe has been gone for 50 years, yet she is just as much in the public eye as she was when she was alive. She's been the subject of songs, books, movies, and even recently a television series about a Broadway play. What makes her so endearing? Well, on the line with us right now from California is Mary Jane Popp. She is the author of Marilyn, Joe, and Me, which shares the stories of Marilyn's friend, June DiMaggio, the niece of the great Yankee ball player. Hi, Mary.
Hi, how you doing? It's a pleasure to talk with you. And yes, 50 years later, but you know, the reason that she's still an icon, she died when she was only 36 years old, Peter. I mean, nobody's ever going to see her with gray hair and wrinkles. She's always going to be that beautiful icon.
That is true. Now, before you even started writing this book, you must have realized that there's so much out there that garners attention when it deals with Marilyn.
Oh, you bet. Now, the reason I did is because, yeah, there's a lot of books out there, and there's going to be rumors out the yazoo for eternity. However, I wanted to talk to someone who was there, who knew Marilyn, and June knew Marilyn for like 11 years, who was part of the family. She was part of her family. She married Joe DiMaggio, June's uncle. So I wanted someone who had the firsthand experience. That's the reason I got involved in this project, and that's the reason it's a work of love.
How did you come into contact with June?
Oh, that was funny. Back in 1980, believe it or not, I did my first radio show, and I had Bob Slater on. He is the one who claimed that he was married to Marilyn for like 2.5 minutes and then had an annulment in Mexico, and he wrote a book. So after the show, I get this call from this disembodied voice, and she said, "Excuse me, the guy you just had on the air is full of baloney." And I said, "Excuse me, who the heck are you?" And she said, "I'm June DiMaggio. My uncle is Joe DiMaggio. My mother and father, Tom and Louise DiMaggio, own DiMaggio's restaurant on Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco. I knew Marilyn 11 years. That's not the Marilyn that I knew." I said, "Well, come on my show and tell me about it." She did, but, you know, there's a limited time to tell things. So over the years, we got to be friends. And when her friend, Barbara Klein, who was the vocal coach to the Stars and her vocal coach, for that matter, passed away, just before she did, she told June, she said, "You know, you have so many wonderful stories, not only about Marilyn and Joe, but people like Ann Southern and Barbara Stanwyck and Hugh O'Brien and Carol Channing. You've got to tell these stories." Well, the majority of the book is still about, of course, Marilyn Monroe and Joe DiMaggio. But it's old Hollywood and what it really was like. And that I found out that Marilyn wasn't this wiggly little teeny little voice girl. No, she was intelligent. She could quote Emerson without the book. She was generous, sensitive. She was all these things. And that's the person that I wanted to know.
So basically what you're saying, which a lot of people never really seem to understand, is the Marilyn we know, the Marilyn we have always seen, was an actress, a very good actress.
Thank you, Peter. You hit the nail right on the head. She was great at what she did, and she was no dumb blonde. This was a smart woman, but she knew how to get, she wanted to get to be a star. She became a star. But the thing is, she so desperately wanted to be a dramatic actress, Peter. That was her dream. I mean, she even auditioned for 20th Century, the big moguls, the mucky mucks, and she had a scene all set up because she wanted to be in that movie, The Brothers Karamazov, in the worst way. Well, she auditioned for them, and they were very good to her. They said, oh, yeah, you're just a great, you know, very good at what you do as a dramatic actress, but we've got our dramatic actresses. You're our sex goddess. You know, that's the end of the story. They made money from her that way. They weren't going to change.
So what, I mean, you've known... You've known about June for a while. You've been friends for a long time. And putting this book together, what did you learn about Marilyn that most people don't know?
Okay, what I learned is that she was, as I said, very intelligent. That was number one. So, and she had her own production company, you know, at the very end. It had been waning, but it was starting to pick up again. So I think that if she would have lived, she died at 36. We never saw her with wrinkles and gray hair, so she's going to be an icon, that beautiful woman forever. However, if she would have lived, I think she would have been the Oprah of her time by being able to pick and choose her own productions. She would have moved on, and probably the most stark thing that really was sad and still brings tears to June's eyes when I bring it up, on the day that she was buried, that Marilyn Monroe was buried, she was going to remarry Joe, and that, to me, is sad. Because they were star-crossed lovers. Joe and Marilyn never fell out of love. When Marilyn had any problems, who did she call? Joe. When Arthur Miller put her into the Payne Whitney Institution in New York because he thought she was having a nervous breakdown, who did she call? Joe. Joe came up from Florida in a flash, walked into this place and said, not you have my ex-wife here. He said, you have my wife here. I want her out, and I want her out now. And he still carried a lot of weight, and he got her out. They were going to be remarried. She was looking for a family. And the Italian family that Joe was part of, obviously with nine brothers and sisters, was what she was looking for. And I think finally Joe realized he was marrying a star. He wasn't marrying a little Italian girl. The first time around, they were star-crossed. He was retiring. The last game that he played was 1951, the World Series. She was just coming up into her own as a star. So it was not meant to be the first time around. I think it would have been wonderful the next time around, but it was not meant to be.
We've always heard these stories about that first romance and how it broke up because, like you say, she was a star on the rise. And maybe at that time, with his career just ending, he might not have been able to handle the icon that Marilyn was becoming. So having said that, of course, Joe lived a lot longer than she did.
Yep.
What did he think of the frenzy and the mystique of what Marilyn became in death?
Oh, he was livid. He was livid. I've got pictures in the book. I've got 80 photos in the book, most of which have never been seen before. But in the photos that I have from the funeral, you can see how he felt about it. He had it all cordoned off with fence. And the fans and the media, everything was kept behind the fence. If you see the group of people there, you don't see any big stars there. Because his thing was, they disrespected her in life, they're not going to disrespect her in death. I mean, he was that protective. He planned everything. He planned the whole funeral. Everything was what he wanted and how he wanted it, not how, you know, the big Hollywood moguls wanted it. He just wasn't going to have any of that anymore. But he was devastated. I mean, on his deathbed, he told June, he said, June, do not be sad for me. I'm going to see my Marilyn. I'm happy. I mean, that you tell me if they weren't in love, you know? And the other thing, too, is they were going to be remarried on the day that she died. Not died, but was buried. Right. And, I mean, she was murdered. I'll tell you straight out right now. Now, we've got a lot of details. I know we don't have a whole lot of time to go into the details now, but we go into it because June's mother was on the phone with Marilyn Monroe when she was murdered.
Wow. Who do you think did it?
June said that her mother wouldn't tell her, that she did the Italian thing. She put her fingers up to her lips and pulled it across like a zipper. She said, "I will never tell what I heard because I want you to live." However, I talked to some people in Southern California, and this one man said he claims that he talked to one of the two people who killed Marilyn Monroe, and it was pretty gruesome. We go into as much detail as I can within reason, and that they were sent by Giancana out of Chicago. Now, you got to connect the dots here. Giancana, Chicago, the Kennedys were friends with Giancana. Connect the dots. What does it tell you?
Conspiracy theory all the way around.
And it was a diary. She had a diary. Now, what was in that diary, nobody really knows. And maybe it was nothing. Maybe it was just, you know, a girl diary. But nobody knows for sure because it's gone.
One last question, and this again goes back to Joe DiMaggio and his love for her. After Marilyn died, he never talked about her.
No, he never talked to. Did you know he never gave an interview in his whole career, in his whole life, to a reporter? And when June, she asked, she said, "Uncle Joe, why don't you talk to the people, talk to the reporters?" He said, "Because they'll take it out of context or they'll misquote me. I'd rather not say anything." And he never gave an interview. This guy was a man that had a lot of integrity. Yeah, he was a little on the cheap side. Now, yeah, and that part was true. But his thing was, a man without integrity is a man without worth. When he would visit his brother at DiMaggio's restaurant on Fisherman's Wharf, and he was in the bar, you know, with his cronies having a drink and smoking and all that, if he saw a family come into the dining room with a child, he would put that drink down, put the smoke out, and go into that dining room and talk to that kid. Because he said, "You know what, they are looking up to me. I have to live up to that image. That image has to be there for that child." I wish they were like that today, but it ain't the same.
The book is called Marilyn, Joe, and Me, and it is written by Mary Jane Popp. And people can go to your website, which is www.popoff, that's popoff.com, correct?
Right, yeah, and I'll do something special for them because of you, Peter, because I've heard great things about you. If they go to that website and they order it there, and I've even knocked off some of the price, they can get an autographed copy by both June and myself. It's the only place they'll be able to get it. So for $24.95 and $5 shipping and handling, it's theirs.
Thank you very much.
And it's a keepsake. It's almost the size of a coffee table book. It's really beautiful.
Thank you very much, Mary Jane.
My pleasure. Peter, anytime. I got tons of stories to tell you if you want to hear more.
Mary Jane Popp, author of Marilyn, Joe, and Me. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0159, and you'll find links to Mary Jane's site, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. It's back to school time, and if you're a parent, you may have already noticed one way that the first week of school is different from when we were kids. Nowadays, the children aren't the only ones getting the assignments. The parents are, too. One of the first things that most schools ask parents to do now is to sign several waivers and authorization forms. By having us acknowledge our responsibilities, schools hope to minimize conflicts and even protect against lawsuits. These kind of forms simply were not needed when most of us went to school, but things are different now. One study reveals that roughly half of all teachers and administrators say that they have been sued or threatened with a lawsuit. Let's be fair, teaching is a tough job, and it's a good time to remind ourselves that we're all teachers, too. Our children watch us to see how we handle difficult situations, and we constantly need to use these opportunities to teach them the importance of respect and civility. Learn more about good alternatives to litigation. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents The Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And we do indeed have Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby from New York City. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello, live from the streets of New York.
Yes, and you know, I would assume that now you've stopped wearing white because Labor Day is here.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's the old joke. It's an old gag about New York City that anybody who wears white after Labor Day is a hick from Iowa. So be warned, ladies and gentlemen, if you're coming to New York City after the end of the summer, which is upon us, and you put on white, everybody will stand on the street saying, ha-ha, there's a farmer from Iowa. No, not really.
Okay, so what does it mean, Labor Day in New York City?
Well, it's a complete change in everything about New York City in the sense that, first of all, people, it's the end of the summer, of course, so people that had beach houses along the Jersey Shore, along Long Island, the Hamptons, and things like that, that all gets closed down. All the swimming pools of the city of New York and the beaches get closed down. And keep in mind, New York City each year hires 2,000 lifeguards. So it gives you an idea of the immensity. I mean, we are certainly a water baby, which a lot of people don't realize. So that aspect of it changed. And then all of a sudden, clothing changes. You know, I mean, I'm speaking as far as this past weekend has been, the temperatures have been very, very hot, but that's going to be ending very soon, and people will start wearing sweaters and sweatshirts and what have you. And then the Broadway Theater will have new openings. Lincoln Center for the Performing Art will have new openings. New Yorkers will start to do more things indoors. So it really, it changes the temper and the tone of the city. And as time goes on, as it gets colder and colder, then nobody sees anybody anymore because everybody's all bundled up, and they got to wait till April to see who's still around.
Meanwhile, let's talk about some news that took place a few weeks ago, or a week ago, at least anyway now, not on a happy note as well. Another disgruntled employee, and I'm talking about the shooting that took place at the Empire State Building. I just want to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, first of all, the first word that came out, it was a terrorism attack at the Empire State Building. I mean, that was, and that nine people were dead. I mean, that was the original reports that were going out. And, of course, the media was thrilled to have such a report. Number one, it had nothing, absolutely, positively nothing to do with the Empire State Building. What happened is that the guy got shot as he was leaving the scene of his one-person murder, passing away from the Empire State Building, but that's not where anything took place. It took place, if anything, around the corner at a company where this guy had been fired from a year ago. Phew, talk about holding your temper for a year. So that was number one. Number two, as far as the nine deaths, there were only two deaths. One death was the perpetrator, and one death was the victim. And the seven people who got shot all got shot by the New York City Police Department. Someplace in there must be, the moral of the story is, I don't know, don't get near a New York City cop, or if he wants to give you a traffic ticket, you better take it. I mean, it's just such inept, you know, police behavior, absolutely outrageous. And, of course, Mayor Bloomberg says, well, the police officers were doing what they were supposed to do. And the police commissioner said the police officers were doing what they were, which is nonsense. This guy was one individual. They could have shot him in the leg. By the way, I'm not expressing any sympathy for him at all. But, I mean, to do that kind of shooting on a busy New York City street and end up shooting seven bystanders, who, by the way, the cops denied it for 3 days. I mean, here you had this great situation where everybody in the city kind of said, yeah, I got a feeling the cops did it. Yeah, I got a feeling the cops did it. The police department kept saying, oh, it's not clear exactly what happened. So anyway, it doesn't say much for the training of the cops. As a matter of fact, these two cops have never, ever fired their guns at all. Hopefully they fired it at a training range. But in any event, seven people got sent to the hospital, and they'll probably get some great lawsuits against the city unless some judge says, well, too bad for you.
But what you just said, and I'm not defending the police here, but what you just said does say something about the safety of New York City, and by that I mean people who watch movies, watch televisions, think that cops always pull their guns, cops are always shooting at people, cops are shooting at perpetrators, and for the most part, most police officers, not just these two, but most police officers, with the exception of firing range, don't fire their guns.
Yeah, well, okay, but, you know, you wonder, you know, I don't know how good you are in a confrontation on the street with a gun in your hand, or how good I am, although I'll be happy to have a shootout with you any day you want to try it, buddy. But the fact of the matter is, these guys are supposedly trained. And now, Peter, you don't mind if I call you Peter, this is the second incident that's occurred in the last few weeks. The first incident was the crazy guy that was running around Times Square with a knife in his hand. And I clearly showed on my website a picture of him backing up from the cops with his hands up in the air, and he got shot dead. So again, I'm certainly not giving any sympathy for these bad people, but at the same time, this is a very crowded, congested city, and cops may have a problem sometime in not being able to fire. And I think in both instances, they used very poor judgment.
Mm. Let's move on to another story I want to talk about, and that is the passing of somebody who is an icon, not just in the United States, but around the world. Neil Armstrong, the first man to walk on the moon. And I understand you have a connection with the man in the moon.
Of course, I have a connection with everybody. As you know, I was in the Army, active in reserve for 39 years. Our three children are all in the United States Army. So I have a definite connection to the United States Army in my twilight years. A number of years ago, my wife and I went to a very fancy military ball at the Waldorf Astoria. And we were sitting at a table with Mrs. Douglas MacArthur. How's that for a name dropping?
Wow.
Can't get much bigger than that, okay? A sweet little woman who was about the height of my wife, so they were getting along quite fabulously. We didn't know the woman before the dinner, but we certainly got a chance to chat with her. And while we're talking to her, I get a feeling that there's somebody standing behind me, kind of, you know, like waiting to get his two cents in, or maybe eavesdropping on the conversation, or maybe waiting to say hello to Mrs. Douglas MacArthur. And before I can continue that thought process, Mrs. Douglas MacArthur says, "Lalina and Peter, I'd like you to meet my very good friend Neil Armstrong." So, I mean, even now I'm babbling. So I turn around and he's there and he extends his hand to me. And of course I shook his hand, which by the way, I've never washed since that day. But I got to tell you something. You know, that was like meeting Christopher Columbus. And by the way, he wasn't coming in as a second fiddle, because you could have a tough time finding many people more famous than Mrs. Douglas MacArthur. So we were already in the top echelon of the world's human beings. But Neil Armstrong, who will be remembered far after they know George Bush, far after they know Obama, you know, I mean, he is like big time, big town. So I felt a little sad, of course, as many people I'm sure did. But he was very pleasant, very nice. And just standing in his aura, it was like just breathtaking. It really was, because, I mean, you know, talk about larger than life. I mean, this was quite the person who, by the way, just for a little historical note, after that whole thing with the astronaut was over, he just went on to become a college professor at the University of Cincinnati, and nobody heard from him again, basically. So he was a gentle man, certainly.
Oh, very quickly, you just mentioned President Bush, you mentioned President Obama, so you mentioned presidents from both parties. The Republican National Convention ended in Tampa just a little while ago, and the Democrats are having their convention right now. I'm just wondering if you had watched any of the convention. For instance, did you see the other night when Clint Eastwood was on?
Yeah, and he's an actor, okay? Now, first of all, let me make sure everybody understands I detest both parties, and I would like to now publicly apologize for what's going on in the United States. It's a bunch of imbeciles on both sides, all right? Just pure rubbish, and if this is the best that the United States can turn out, we're in big trouble. I happen to like Clint Eastwood. I love Clint Eastwood. I love to watch his movies with popcorn and everything. But he's an actor, okay? Just like Ronald Reagan was an actor, even more so than a regular politician is. So you got to disregard half of what he says and how he says it, because he's playing for the cameras. I thought the Republican convention was an absolute embarrassment. I thought Romney's speech was just blah, just absolutely nothing. This guy from New Jersey, the fat guy, who they're saying is the great governor, everything, is not the great governor. New Jersey's having all kinds of troubles and problems. And I read someplace that it took him 16 minutes until he even mentioned Romney's thing. So what is the setup that we have here? Peter, are you ready to permit me to antagonize most of your listeners with the following comments?
Sure.
On one hand, you got a petty black crook from the Chicago political machine. And on the other hand, you got a perpetual candidate for president who's the member of a cult. How's that?
Wow, you don't hold back, do you?
But that's what they are. And I mean, it's as simple as that, okay? And if I've offended anybody, I'm just telling you what they are. They're two terrible people. I mean, I could spend the next 4 days discussing it with you. The leadership of the United States is blah, and unfortunately, as we go down the toilet, so will everybody else.
Wow. Okay. On that note, let's end it on something happy, since obviously I've struck a nerve about the political situation. I'm almost afraid to find out who you're going to vote for in November, but that's something maybe we'll talk about.
It's a big problem. No, but that's a big problem. As you know, most people in the United States don't vote anyway.
Yeah.
And I got a big problem. I had the same problem with McCain. I'm a war hero. And Obama, who comes from, I mean, forget about the black thing or any, the Chicago, Illinois political machine is so unbelievably corrupt. I mean, they gave Kennedy the election by stuffing the ballot boxes. So, I mean, you just got two bad guys running, and maybe that's the reason the United States is in such a mess. I've said to you many, many times, the only person qualified to be president of the United States is me.
Okay. I think, by the way, I want to correct something. I don't know if they really stuffed the ballot boxes for Kennedy, so much so that maybe the ballot boxes for Nixon are at the bottom of Lake Michigan.
Well, okay. But,
anyway.
I mean, that's, you know, I realize that when I start to talk about a cult and I talk about a black guy, you know, that raises the rankles on a lot of people. But that's what can I tell you? I mean, that is the reality of the situation, I think.
Anyway, Peter,
the Washington Post to say it, but they won't.
We're running out of time, so I want to ask you quickly about the wedding announcement of the week.
What I do is I check out the New York Times, which, by the way, I once worked for once upon a time, and I once upon a time decided which wedding announcements would be in the New York Times. And this was very happy days because it was a lot of fun to do that. So I enjoy reading them, and I now enjoy passing them along. The one that you've just mentioned, the reason that I'm citing it this week, is on one hand, she is a lawyer for the government, and he, on the other hand, is a public relations person for the government. So I'm thinking a lawyer for the government, public relations person for the government, that's a marriage where only Satan could be the best man.
Wow, you're on a roll today, sir. You're on a roll. And if anybody wants to send thoughts and questions to you, don't send them to me if you got a problem with what Peter said. The email address is peter@gabby.com. People can also check out your website at www.gabby.com. Peter, I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
I thank you.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about at a racetrack with this edition of the Stuff File program. We have time for one more item, and that would be the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
In July, a California appeals court reinstated police officer Enrique Chavez's lawsuit against the Austrian gun manufacturer Glock for its unsafe design. Chavez is now paralyzed from the waist down because his 3-year-old son got hold of the gun and accidentally fired it, hitting his dad. Chavez, in violation of police policies, had left the gun loaded underneath the front seat of his car, and his son, whom Chavez had not belted into a child seat, was free to explore while dad drove. The gun is regarded as a safe design by dozens, if not hundreds, of police departments, and the LAPD disciplined Chavez over the incident. So, the question has to be asked. Why would someone simply not take responsibility for their own dumb moves by not securing a child in the car seat, and remember, he is a law enforcement officer, and by not securing the gun properly, but instead putting it under the seat, fully loaded, then try to sue the gun manufacturer for his own stupidity? One reason, and one reason only, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0159. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's number 0159. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've experienced another edition of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Now, doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? Like watching puppies and kittens frolicking in a field of daisies. Like the smells coming from Grandma's kitchen. Like the hallucinogenics you took in the 60s and I'm taking right now. Hello, cartoon birdies. Perhaps I've said too much. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let the glow wash over you and enjoy. Peace out.